Okay, here we are on Wednesday. Wednesday, yes, Wednesday. And we're all geared up and ready to go. Except that you can't hear me, but I will see what I can do about that. I will overpower you with the volume here until I get the floor. I have the floor, right? Good. So, now that I have the floor, I do. I think I do. I do. Okay. All right, I'm just going to do it anyway. So, how many of you are having problems getting the schedule that you want? How many of you are sophomores and won't have problems until tomorrow? And first-year students who get their problems on Friday. Sorry about that. Okay. We did change 60, so those of you who are planning to take it, be aware that it is an hour later than it was originally scheduled for, and probably creates all kinds of conflicts for you. But at least we'll have a room. We won't be out in the green. And the exams and leftover writing exercises are here, the exam analysis from before is there. This is the distribution on this exam. The mean is, I'm told, 52, something like that. And you find out your score and where you are by adding the number correct on the Scantron to the total points on your essay. And that's the distribution of those totals. So if you got 50 and up, you're doing fine. And if you got less than you hoped to get and are not doing as well as you would like, Talia has lots of suggestions about that. And I could probably come up with a couple too. So review all of the tips on studying, all of the workshops, all of those sorts of things, and haul yourself out before the final. What else? The second exam writing exercise is on the website, and the key is on the wall outside C150 during normal office hours, like 8 to 5 or something like that. And we will have a distribution of the total scores, all your points so far. I'm not sure we can put that on the website, but I'll see. If not, I will at least put the mean and the range up on the website tomorrow. Okay. Anything else? Any other business? When you come back from Thanksgiving break, we'll ask you when you would like to have review sessions. Our last class is 3 weeks from today. Huh. And the exam is 4 weeks from the day before yesterday. It's on the Monday of exams.
So
how is this particular distribution divided by letter grades? It isn't. So, because it doesn't make much sense to do that. If you're above the mean, you're doing okay, and if you're in the bottom of it, you're not doing okay, unless you're taking the course pass fail, and then it may be okay, but you want to bring it up. What the important one at this point is the total of all of your points. Since some people have done the exam analysis, some people have done both of them already, and some people haven't done and don't intend to, they will have much lower point totals. So that's the one that's important. And I will give you an approximate letter grade to go on that distribution on Monday when you come back. The final is just on psychosocial development, except that it will assume, let me back that up. It focuses on psychosocial development. All of the questions will have something to do with psychosocial development, but it will ask you to connect psychosocial to the other two units and integrate it. But I won't go back and ask dumb questions about biological development. I'll ask intelligent questions about biological development and psychosocial development. So this is your task, to make sure that all the questions really do touch on psychosocial development, Talia. Thank you. The format for the final is the same, except that there are more multiple choice questions. No, I don't know how many, because we haven't written it yet. How many more? Probably, instead of 50, there'll probably be 70, maybe 75. Depends on how ambitious Talia gets between now and then. Okay? All right. So, let me take a quick romp. On Monday, we talked a bit about attachment. Actually, we talked quite a bit about attachment and attachment styles. And I suggested that it's interesting to think about how attachment styles get carried over onward, upward, beyond, forward from infancy and toddlerhood into childhood and adolescence and into adulthood. And suggested that if you look at the kinds of attachment styles, the four types that are described in the text, you can think about yourself and your friends and see if perhaps one or more of those fit you. And then think about what happens when you put people trying to create a relationship, two people trying to create a relationship who have either the same or differing attachment styles. And that's become a popular line of research as people are starting to try to get a handle on relationship implications of the attachment literature. Some of that research is kind of interesting. Some of it is fairly bogus, and the text doesn't, in fact, deal with adult relationships from an attachment perspective. So you get to speculate all you would like. What the text does do, though, is ask the question whether the attachment style carries over from generation to generation in parenting behavior, and gives a qualified yes to that, suggesting that if you look at how people were parented, the kind of attachment style that they developed in childhood, if you look at them when they are parenting their own children 20 or 25 years later, there may be some similarity there, that people have developed a style in the parent-child transaction as children that when they get on the other side of that transaction, they will carry over. There are not very many longitudinal studies that actually look at that. Some of the studies that have focused on it have been trying to get people to retrospectively describe how they were parented, and that's always very, very dangerous kind of research to do, because in fact most people don't have any idea what they were like as children or how they were parented except from what their parents have said. For example, there are lots of retrospective studies and people are trying to remember back that are really funny. One of them I recommend to you is to try to figure out whether you were an early or late maturer going through puberty. It's interesting. If you ask people, they think they know, but if you actually go back and look at their records, they don't. What they remember is whether they were earlier or later than their best friends. But that's not the same as being an early or late maturer. On the other hand, it turns out that being earlier or later than your best friends is what is really important within the peer group, and that may have impact. But if you can't remember back 5 or 6 years to whether you matured early or later, it's unlikely that you will know very much about how you were parented when you were a year old. So we have to take the data with a grain of salt. But what it raises for us is what the parents are doing as they're creating that attachment style, and that opens the door to a more general field of interest, which is parenting styles in general. Not just how you're trying to create a relationship with the child, but what are you doing as a parent, and how do we conceptualize that? The text describes a group of parenting styles, primarily based on the research of Diana Baumrind, and I'll put her name up on the screen in a minute. But if you look at most of the research on parenting behavior, what you can rate fairly reliably, what raters interviewing parents and watching parent-child relationships can get, what they can focus on and agree on pretty well, are four dimensions. The kinds of demands that people make for maturity in their children. Do they expect you to stay a baby? Do they expect you to grow up? The kinds of control they expect to exercise over your behavior. How nurturing they are, the warm and fuzzy affectionate dimension. And how much they communicate with you about what their expectations are and what you're doing. Do they explain things or not? Expanding on those a bit, and this is on the website, if you look at maturity demands, the questions that we ask are, how appropriate are the demands for maturity? And you have a dimension from very low expectations to very high expectations. And the ends of that continuum really are inappropriately low expectations. You don't expect the child to be able to do things that the child is fully capable of doing. And at the other end, absurdly high expectations that are out of line with what the child is actually able to do. And in the middle, you have age-appropriate expectations. So you think about your own parents and what they expected of you, and whether you wished they had had higher expectations or whether you had wished that they had lightened up a little bit and not expected you to be able to whatever the rub was. Looking at control, the question is, how do parents attempt to influence the child's behavior? Over how many aspects of life do they expect to exercise control? How much do they insist that you comply? So some of you have parents who are still trying to control your life. Some of them do it affectionately. They call you to make sure that you know that it's raining out and that you have your umbrella and warm clothing. Those are the parents on the phone 6 times a day to make sure you're eating well and getting enough sleep. They wake you up while you're taking a nap to find out if you're, you know, those kinds of parents. Some of you have parents who are happy to get rid of you, and whatever you do from now on is up to you, and they're not going to try to give you advice. The dimension runs from very little concern about controlling through a moderate degree of control. We want to influence you, but you make your own choices. To the other end, a very great concern to control the child's behavior and to insist on compliance. So some parents we call authoritarian expect to be in charge of your life. That's why they had you, so they would have something they could control, and they would be very happy if you came with a little joystick so that they could run you through your paces like a remote control toy. And they don't want you to do anything without checking with them first and doing what they tell you to do. Hopefully none of you have or become that kind of parent. Nurturance. How affectionate are they? Do you remember getting hugged, kissed? Were they warm? They hold your hand? They like being with you, snuggle up while you watch TV, that kind of stuff. How interested are they in your welfare and in your feelings? Do they care about your feelings and your welfare and your best interests? And how supportive are they? If you have a problem, are they supportive and nurturing about that? Do they offer assistance? They can offer assistance by telling you what to do, which is connected to control, or they can assure you that everything will be fine and help you think about the options that you have, but expect you to make up your own mind. That's a low degree of control with appropriate guidance. So the dimension is from cold and unaffectionate and uninterested through moderate degree of concern on up to very warm and affectionate and loving and supportive and maybe too much. I was talking with a friend a couple of weeks ago who says that it's wonderful, and it drives him nuts because in his 50s his mother is still very concerned. He was talking with her about something that he had goofed up on, and she was essentially not hearing him because it's impossible for her to accept that he would make a mistake or be less than perfect. So she was assuring him that he was really fine and what he did, probably he was misunderstanding it. And she's on the very warm, loving, supportive end, but on the unrealistic side of that. He wasn't upset terribly about what he had done. He just was talking about it. And she couldn't hear that because she loves him so much. Okay, communication. The issues are, how much do the parents explain their expectations? How much do they describe things? How much do they really attempt to help the child understand the world? How much is the child encouraged to express that understanding? That's a two-way street, the transaction that includes making sure that the child is developing the understanding and that you get the expression of that. And how much do you let the child participate in decisions that affect her? And the dimension is from very little explanation and very little listening, which we call a closed style. One way the parent explains but doesn't listen. Parent listens but doesn't explain. That's the other way. And then the open or reciprocal, which is the parent explains and encourages expression. So there's discussion of things that are going on and an attempt to help the child develop a valid understanding of his or her behavior, your behavior, the expectations. You make sure that you have a relationship with the child in which the child understands the expectations are appropriate, and you give whatever assistance is necessary so that you make sure the child can do the things that you want the child to do. Okay? So each of these then can be, you can combine them in any way you want. These are the four dimensions that researchers keep coming back to. These are the things that people really do differ on, and they're fairly consistent, and they have specific consequences for the parent-child transaction. So if you put them together, then you get, let's use this one. And this is on the website, so don't worry too much about it. What it has is where you are on the maturity demands, how much control, how much nurturance, and what kind of communication and how much there is. And different combinations of those four dimensions give you different styles. The authoritarian style, which is the I'm in charge, shape up, if I tell you to jump, jump first, and then on the way up you can ask how high. And then when you get to the top you can ask if it's okay for you to come down yet. That's the parent who has high expectations for you and they're inappropriate, high degree of control, low degree of affection, and closed communication. I'm not interested in what you think, just do it. The authoritative, and you have to be careful as you study these to be clear about the authoritarian and the authoritative. They are very, very different. Authoritarian is based on a description of an authoritarian personality, which was one sociologist's attempt to understand the Nazis in Germany and the Holocaust. Why did so many people obey orders that were clearly immoral? And the conclusion that the sociologist came to was that there was a personality style that was encouraged by parents and schools and by the society that was conditioned, if you will, to obey. Because the parents were raising their kids to obey and they grew up expecting to obey authorities, and the whole society was tending toward an authoritarian style that was hierarchically arranged. You didn't expect explanations, you simply did what you were told, and particularly in military service. The authoritative style refers to actually being an authority on children and parenting, knowing what to do, knowing what is appropriate, and knowing that open communication with kids, explaining yourself and listening to them explain themselves, a high degree of nurturance, relatively high degree of control as a parent, and appropriate maturity demands. So you know what kids can do, and you expect them to do it, and you love them, and you communicate with them, is the way to get things to happen well. And kids who are raised in an authoritative household have the best outcomes in every way that you can possibly imagine and measure, and the text reviews those. What I would ask you to do is to think about the text, because it's set up in stages. Think about how the parenting styles are manifested at each stage. How do you be an authoritarian parent with an infant? Tell a six-month-old to shut up, I guess. I don't know. How do you do it with an adolescent? The outcomes for different parenting styles are different depending on the stage that you're in, but also how you parent is different because the expectations and the capabilities of children are different. So the text doesn't integrate across those stages, but you might try doing that. The permissive indulgent style is labeled for fairly obvious reasons that you don't have high expectations. Kids can do what they want. You're not trying to control them, so you're permissive. Nurturing is high. You like kids, you just don't like making demands on them. And they can say anything they want, and you'll talk to them about anything they want to ask you about, so there's very open communication. But the expectations are low, and the control is low. So many of us are indulgent and permissive parents because we really like kids and we think they ought to grow up like little flowers, and if you just water them, they're fine, and that's fine. But you can imagine what happens. We create monsters who think they're entitled to everything and they don't have to shape up, and they have problems when they get out into society because we haven't taught them any self-regulation. And we've taught them that everybody loves them and they can say whatever they want, and may be true at home, but it may not be true at school or at work. They may have trouble with authoritative teachers. And then there's the neglectful end of permissive, which is the parents who really don't like kids, aren't very affectionate, don't care particularly what you do. In fact, they wonder why they have you. And you're kind of a bother. So they're not going to talk to you. They don't care what you think. They're not going to kiss and hug you because they really don't like you. They're not going to control you. And their expectations are low. The difference between these two is the communication and the affection. So you can be permissively parented by somebody who loves you to death but isn't going to restrict you, and will talk to you about anything, and will encourage your creativity, and doesn't mind if you paint on the walls or on the neighbor's walls. You know. Well, look, he made a sunshine. He made a rainbow. Yes, but it's my house. He's not my kid. You know. I would like him to apologize and clean it up. Oh, but you don't want to erase it. It's so beautiful. And my baby did it. And then you have the other kind of parent who doesn't care what you did because he doesn't care. So that's the kid who draws the rainbow or the sunset or whatever, the sunrise on your house, and the parent says, yeah, it's pretty ugly. And that's all there is to it. Okay? So these are fairly self-evident. You've probably read them in other places. What they are describing is different transactions between parents and children. And in a constructivist view, what you're doing is setting up a set of expectations for the child. You're creating a world view for the child, a way of looking at the world, and the child's place in it. And the kid is going to take that along with her. And different kinds of transactions and expectations and attitudes and the behaviors, of course, that go along with them lead to different kinds of expectations and behaviors on the part of the child. I guess there's no quibbling with that. It's self-evident. It's one of those things your grandmother knows. And she knows it regardless of what kind of parenting style she uses. Okay? I said I'll put Baumrind up there. Diana Baumrind was one of the people who sort of created the best kind of research on these styles and studied the children and families over a long period of time in her research in California. And we all kind of follow along with her because the research keeps getting replicated. And we find the same things. Okay. Let me suggest Diana Baumrind had at the beginning two dimensions, nurturance and control, The others have been added as refinements, so all four of those show up in her data as it's been added to. The point I wanted to make is about the categories. If you think about what kind of parent you had, you may discover that some parents change over time. As some of us like children at different stages better than we like children at other stages, some of us may be very indulgent and permissive with infants and toddlers, and then when a kid gets to school age, we become much less indulgent and permissive. And when you get to be an adolescent, we may become authoritarian because we remember what we did as adolescents. So it's truly a transaction between the child and the stage the child is in and the way the child is behaving and the parents' expectations. And those expectations change as the children develop and as the parent is having transactions with the child. They also may change because children are different. You can have a sibling who's a hellion, and the parents discover along the way that they need to be much more controlling of that sibling, that child, than they are of a child who's easy and conforms naturally. Some kids expect and require more control. Some kids come along and they're simply self-regulating, and other kids aren't. And parents who are knowledgeable about their children will change the degree of control that they attempt to use or that they feel is necessary. There's also, for many of you, the reality that you have two parents and they have different styles because there are some gender differences in the way people behave and what they expect of children. And the differences between parents are one of the major sources of conflict between parents. Parents who disagree about the expectations for children have an ongoing problem. Parents who disagree about how much control, how much nurturance, how much communication is appropriate end up having conflict with each other because they disagree. And sometimes they'll figure out a way to be different. And some of you grew up in families where the communication with mom was very open, communication with dad was closed. That's the stereotypic. Dad doesn't express much and doesn't listen much, but is happy if you're happy, and lets mom do all the emotional, warm, fuzzy stuff. Mom may be very affectionate, dad not affectionate. That's also part of the stereotype. There are families that reverse that. There are families where mom is the enforcer and doesn't care to talk very much about it, and dad is the warm, fuzzy one that you learn to go to when you need some nurturing because he'll listen and he doesn't have high expectations, so, and he's not as controlling. He figures that's mom's business, and he's happy just to sit down and chat. Okay. So disagreements about parenting style are a major problem between parents, and they are often cited when couples come into counseling or in the process of divorce because they've had very different styles. One of the things I said on Monday was that I'm an optimist. The question was raised about whether or not you can change your attachment style. And I generalized that to, can you change your parenting style? Can you raise your kids differently than you were raised? And my response to that was, I'm an optimist, but if you're going to change it, it has to be deliberate, conscious, and you have to work at it. Because if just saying that you're going to be different will not make it a difference because you don't know how to have the transactions in any other way. So if you think kids need more control than was exercised over you, you still have to figure out how to do that because you haven't had experience with a transaction in which there was a moderate to high degree of control. So when you get your own to practice on, you actually have to practice, and it has to be deliberate, so you, because it's not going to come naturally to do it differently than was done to you. Some of you know you don't want to parent like your parents did, but what will happen to you if you're at all normal is there will be times as your children grow up when you will discover that you sound just like your mother or your father, and you will have heard it before. And it's often a surprise when we hear ourselves saying things we thought we would never say. But you can't erase them. They're in there, and they come out when you don't want them to come out. So in order to change parenting style and develop something that you've not experienced, you have to study parenting. You have to practice. You have to be deliberate about it. It helps to read books. It helps to take classes. And it helps to respond when you see yourself doing what you wish you weren't doing. So you have to do the post-mortem on your own behavior when you screw up, when you blow it, you've done something wrong. You need to sit down and say, okay, why did I do that? What should I have done? What could I have done differently? And now let's rehearse that so that I can actually be a different kind of parent than I had. Questions about that whole ball of wax? Caitlin. Sounds good to me. It's called an honest apology to a kid that you have just disrespected. And it's open communication. It says parents are fallible, and we all make mistakes, and I just made one, and I can't take back what I said, but I will tell you that I sure don't mean it, and I won't say it again. And now let's look at the situation, so we can figure out how you can help me be a better parent. You have to swallow your parental perfection occasionally, and you discover that it doesn't taste very good. But if you want to be the kind of parent who has open communication with a kid and who doesn't scream, yell, hit, all of those things that you swore you'd never do, you have to make sure that you're ready to apologize. And it actually doesn't hurt to apologize to a kid. It also gives them the lesson that perhaps if they make mistakes, they might be able to admit them too and apologize, and you'll accept their apology as they're accepting yours. And then you have a much more affectionate the possibility of a much more affectionate and communicative relationship, because the kid isn't scared to death that if they do something wrong, you're going to yell and scream and hit them. So what you said is just fine for kids. I don't like it when I lose my temper and spank you when you're being disobedient and flagrantly so, and I only spank you because I couldn't think of anything else to do, and it's not what I want to do, so we need to sit down and figure out what else I could do and how you could do differently so that we don't get in that situation again. And you process the situation with the kid and say, okay, I told you 6 times, how could I tell you so that you actually hear? And how can I not blow up? How can you respond to me in a way that helps me not blow up, so you define a different kind of transaction with the child. It takes time. It takes time for both. I'm sorry, how can you have... Yes, just the way I did. just the way I just did. You can have that conversation about having made a mistake with a 3-year-old. Yeah. Kids are much brighter than we often give them credit for. You choose your vocabulary. Although 3-year-olds and, 4-year-olds like it if you acknowledge that you were feeling irascible today. And they can't spell it and neither can you, but it has an SC in the middle and it's a really neat word which says, when I'm feeling irascible, anybody's going to irritate me, and you did, and that's my fault. So I'm going to teach you about the emotional transaction that we're having. So when I tell you I'm feeling irascible, you need to walk on eggshells a little bit. And then what happens is the 4-year-old wakes up one morning and tells you, I'm feeling irascible. And you say, okay, how can I help? That's good parenting. Yeah, I'm a big proponent of talking about situations with kids, very, very young kids, because even if they don't understand the words, they will understand the tone of voice, they will understand what you're trying to do, and they will appreciate that. If you hit a kid because the kid did something that that you couldn't tolerate at the moment and you didn't have any better response, or if you yell at a kid, approaching the child positively and reestablishing the affectionate connection and helping the child see that you can talk about situations like that, and that you still love them and you're frustrated or you're whatever. They can hear that. And that's very different than if you yell and then pretend it didn't happen and ignore the kid and go off and do your own thing, which says to them, whoops, no relationship. And makes them very anxious. So the way you respond when you blow it is important. And talking with children quietly and even beyond their ability to listen is far better than ignoring them or sending them to their room because you're not as good as you wish you were. And those skills that the child is learning in that situation, that you can talk about things when something goes wrong, that you can apologize, that you can lose it with somebody and still love them and work with them to improve the relationship, I hope you hear as something that you want to take into adult relationships. And kids who have had open communication and nurturance and age-appropriate expectations make better partners than people who are focusing on obedience and power and non-communication. You don't want them as partners because they're going to partner you the way they were parented. And you don't want that. So what the parents are doing in their parenting is teaching the child how to have a relationship. And that includes how to behave when you've been wrong. And parents are, or are not, teaching the child that you can be wrong, parents are wrong, partners are wrong, we're all wrong at times, we're all unthinking or just not up to our own standards at times, and the best approach to that, to maintain the relationship, is to acknowledge it and to apologize and to work with the other person in the transaction to improve the relationship. But if everything is somebody else's fault, you're not going to get that to happen. Okay, let me talk about one of my favorite theorists for a little bit. The 28-minute version of Sullivan. Harry Stack Sullivan is not mentioned in the text. He never is. But he has some very useful ideas about relationships and about development. Sullivan was a psychiatrist and psychoanalyst who taught in New York and in Washington, and wrote some interesting books about relationships and development and psychiatric disorders. He has an interpersonal theory of psychiatry, which is what I use as my primary source in looking at his theory. It's fun to read. He grew up on a farm in upstate New York as an only child, which I think probably affected him some way. He was also Irish, which I know affected him some way. And he writes kind of like James Joyce at times. If you've read James Joyce, Ulysses, or others, I love Irish literature, and I love William Butler Yeats, and I love Joyce in all of his voices. And I like Sullivan, but sometimes it helps if you read a little Joyce before you read Sullivan, because it's sometimes a little thick to get through. I won't suggest that you have a stiff drink before, but I find it useful to get into the mood. And since Sullivan, as it turned out, was an alcoholic, I think maybe reading him in his own mood is probably appropriate, but we're not going there. In psychoanalysis, Freud said there's no point trying to do psychoanalysis with psychotic patients. Sullivan spent a fair amount of his career working with young adults who were psychotic in a mental institution, and he tried doing psychoanalysis with them, and the stories around that are lots of fun, including treating patients like they were real human beings. You don't do psychoanalysis by having them lie down on the couch where they can't see you, because psychotic people don't usually like that. So he would have them sit across the desk, and then he'd pull out a fifth of whiskey and pour them each a shot. And then they would do therapy, and the patients liked that and sort of responded reasonably well to it. And he claimed some success in that therapeutic mode. But you can imagine, if you're doing therapy all day long and having a shot with each patient, you know, after a while you're probably not doing very good work. So he was fun. What he did in his work was describe the development of relationships. He grew out of a tradition that said, you don't exist except in your relationships. There is no point even thinking about people without thinking about their relationships. In fact, you can't study a person without creating a relationship. Nobody exists outside relationships. So being social animals and being in relationships is where you have to start for understanding development and our thinking. So he set out to look at what is important about the development of relationships. And this is his fundamental premise, that development involves expansion of the number and variety of relationships that you have that are significant. And in each significant relationship, as you're going from one to another, you're adding different kinds of relationships, you're applying what you learned in previous relationships. And if you attach a little Piaget to that, what you're doing is creating a set of expectations for relationships, a way of understanding the world. And when you get into a different kind of relationship than you've been in before, there's an inevitable disequilibrium. Okay? Because the way you were in previous relationships won't apply to the next relationship that you're in if it's a different kind of relationship. So you're constantly adapting to the expectations and demands of the transactions of new kinds of relationships. So you're differentiating, remember these words? You're differentiating people and ways of relating. Each time you go into a new kind of relationship, you have to figure out how that relationship is different from previous ones, and learn a new way of transacting with the new significant person or category of people that you're relating to. And then along the way, you're integrating those into a repertoire of relationship styles or types that you can have, so that you start off with just one relationship, we all do, caregiver, but then we add other caregiving adults, then we add siblings, then we add other authorities like teachers, and each of those has a different kind of transaction, a different role and a different expectation. And then we add peers and friends, and then as we grow up, we have best friends, we have intimate friends, and eventually we have lovers, and then we have children. You can go on with that. We have grandchildren, and each of those relationships is different. And if you've integrated them pretty well, you go through your day from one relationship to another behaving differently. You've integrated them into this big system, this repertoire, being able to talk to your roommate, then talk to your mother on the phone, then talk to a professor, then talk to your advisor, then talk to a little kid in the childcare center, then talk to the nice people in the marché who are serving you food and taking your money, and you do that all day long. You have all these different kinds of relationships. And you have learned to have each kind as you go along. So it's an interesting way to think about your life, all the different people who are significant. Sullivan may have, I haven't found earlier uses, but when you use the term significant other, Sullivan used that term throughout his work. I think he stole it from somebody else, but when you think about your SO, your significant other, that's what Sullivan is talking about. All the different people who are significant to you. And in each of those relationships, he says, you learn different things. And this is just, I've pulled out some of the characteristics of relationships of different sorts that he elaborates when he talks about development. So with mom, you learn about merging and separating. You start off in a symbiotic, not differentiated relationship with her. There's you and this environment that you're in, which includes mother, and along the way you're going to figure out eventually that you're not the same, that she's a different person from you. You're going to learn how to be cared for, and eventually as you develop in this relationship, you're going to learn to please, and you're also going to learn what happens when you don't please. And you all recognize that. How does mom behave when you are displeasing her? In my family, it comes down to one gesture, and everybody in the family knows this one. You probably will recognize it. When you have displeased my mother, she won't tell you usually, but she will do this. I said, puts her tongue in her upper lip, pushes it out. Everybody in the family knows that you have just gotten on the wrong side. You have just done something that you probably shouldn't have done, and you might want to reconsider fairly quickly. But that's all that happens. It's very subtle. It's also very powerful. And you shape up, right? That's what you do when your parent tells you that you're not doing what you're supposed to do. Why do you do that? Because it arouses anxiety. It says, whoops, something is wrong in this relationship. I need to rethink it. And we'll come back to the anxiety a bit later. With your parents, generally, you learn to seek help. You learn to differentiate mom from dad. Mom from mom, if you have two, or dad from dad, if you have two. Aunts and uncles that live with you. I don't know what I dropped after disappointing. Let's go back to my notes. I meant to type something else in there. With siblings, you learn about sharing. You know, give your little brother half of what you have. Caring for, being cared for. Competing with siblings. Accepting difference, because most of us have siblings who are younger or older or both. With other adults, we learn about authority. And Sullivan talks about all of these at considerable length to talk about how our personalities and our social skills and our social understanding are developing as we grow up and experience each of these kinds of relationships. So I'm just skimming across the top of his paragraph topics in this. I think it's fairly self-evident and interesting to think about. With peers, you learn to share experience. You learn to cooperate, lead, and follow. You participate in mass culture with your peers. You go to school, and they know all about, what do they know about? Whatever the fad is of the day. Pirates of the Caribbean. Santa Claus. Whatever. It's peers who perpetuate that culture, and what some of us experience is that we're not part of it. This is a problem, so we need to learn about it as we encounter peers who engage us in it and expect it. It becomes part of the roles that we play in fantasy. We have to learn about sports. We have to learn about the roles in sports. We have to figure out whether we like the Yankees or the Red Sox. And heaven forbid if you're the one kid in Burlington High School who follows the Atlanta Braves. The peer group expects you to know particular things and to be able to play particular games. And so we learn to pay attention to the things that our peer group is paying attention to. And it's in childhood that you start doing that. We do it the rest of our lives, of course, but you learn to do it in childhood, and you develop some attitudes about it. Some of us like being the one who doesn't watch television. It's okay. Others wouldn't be caught dead not knowing what everybody else does. And if you're a boy, you'll even pretend that you do know. Maybe girls do that too, but I've always thought of it as a guy thing to pretend that you know everything. You're an expert on baseball or whatever it is, because you need to do that in the peer group to be accepted. You also learn with the peer group about aggressing, defending yourself, intervening, all of those bully kinds of things, negotiating, and reestablishing the friendship. You learn a style for doing that. Sullivan didn't talk very much, but I will just mention that there are also in peer groups in childhood, there are two cultures. In our culture, there are two cultures. There's the boy peer group and there's the girl peer group. And they're different. And they have different standards and different expectations. And they do things differently. So one of the things that happens with the peer group is that you learn how boys do things and how girls do things. And you deal with the cootie issue as you figure out that the other culture is completely unacceptable and indefensible, and you'd better not be part of it. If you're a boy, you'd better not be a girl, and if you're a girl, you probably better not be a boy. As we develop real friendships, as we get up into third, fourth, fifth grade, the friendships change, and we learn about collaborating and sharing our feelings and our thoughts. Not just playing games with people, but actually thinking about ourselves and about them. And then we develop what Sullivan calls intimacy, which is the ability to share thoughts and feelings that you wouldn't normally share with just anybody. You need a special kind of trust and a special kind of relationship to do that. And he says we begin to develop that at the end of childhood as we move into adolescence. And then we practice that with our best friends, either same sex or other sex, doesn't matter. We can have intimate relationships with them. intimate in his case doesn't mean sexual, it means psychological, emotional. And we learn interdependence, being able to rely on each other, being able to trust each other, and the emphasis is on the each other, so that it's mutual and reciprocal. And then eventually, we get married and become lovers. Well, maybe we don't get married, but anyway. You're learning different things, commitment and fidelity, as you begin to establish the kind of relationship that you want to have as an adult. And you have to incorporate sexuality into that relation. Well, you don't have to, most of us do. Figure out how to be sexual with each other and maintain the relationship and accept and recognize that you can only be in a sexual relationship comfortably with one person at a time. Eventually. That's what fidelity is about. And commitment. Or you decide that you can be sexual with a whole bunch of people and be a hippie, live in a commune, whatever, and it's okay. As long as you all agree. I'm not going there. Okay, let me suggest another way in which Sullivan is useful. And if you've looked at the website, I don't even need to do this because it's there. So I'm going to do the quick version. And you can see through this anyway, so all right. Sometimes I get to drag this out and it's more fun that way. Here you go, just all of it. You can absorb the whole thing. I don't have to walk you through it. Sullivan suggested in his theory that there are three interpersonal needs. And that's all. It's a very limited set of needs. And they govern our behavior. Trying to get those needs met, they govern our behavior. And the first one we're born with, which is the need for security in significant relationships. And when we are in a relationship with a caregiver particularly, that's where it starts, with mom, that is secure, our needs are being taken care of, our physical needs, and our need for an interpersonally secure relationship, ideally, is being met because mom is treating us nicely. Think of all of the ways that parents and kids develop attachment, those behaviors are creating a secure relationship if you're developing a secure attachment. Okay? So these approaches to describing what's going on are very closely related to each other. And after break, when we talk about Erikson, or you're reading about Erikson in the text, you read about the establishment of a sense of trust. He's talking about the same thing. Creating security in the relationship, behaving in the transaction in a way that is making the relationship close and positive, and avoiding the problem that we have when we're in a relationship that is not secure. When a relationship ought to be and isn't, we feel anxious. So for Sullivan, we have this need. When we're in a relationship where we could reasonably expect that need to be met, if it's not, we feel anxious. And it's that anxiety that we feel when mom puts her tongue in her upper lip, or frowns, or raises an eyebrow, or whatever your mom did that said, I'm displeased with you. What she's doing is arousing anxiety. She is threatening the relationship. She is saying, you're not living up to my standards. You shouldn't have done that. You need to apologize, change your behavior, shape up, whatever. Okay? That experience of anxiety, Sullivan says, we only experience in a relationship that we expect to be secure. And any time, in his view, any time you experience anxiety, it's because there is a threat to an important relationship. So Sullivan would say, if you get anxious before exams, it ain't about your performance, it ain't about your knowledge, it's about whether or not you're going to disappoint the professor, your roommate, your boyfriend, your girlfriend, your parents. It's about the implied threat to important relationships. That's what the anxiety is about. I don't know if that's true or not. I throw it out there because it's important in his theory that if we're looking at interpersonal relationships, anxiety is what we experience when important relationships are not secure. And we shape up, we change our behavior, we develop new ways of behaving in order to reduce that anxiety and go back to a secure relationship, secure transaction with the person who's important. So parents use that threat to the security to socialize their children. Displeasure tells us we're not doing what we ought to do. We experience the anxiety, we want to avoid it, so we shape up so our parent will be happy with us again. And that's consistent with a lot of the socialization literature and the parenting literature that tries to explain why it is that kids have any interest in becoming human and becoming acceptable human beings. Sullivan says it's because we do have a significant relationship. We have a need for that to be secure, and when it's not, we need to change our behavior to regain the security. Now, the second need I mentioned comes along at the end of childhood and is based on the cognitive developments that are taking place. The cognitive development, as you move toward formal operational thinking, makes it possible for you to understand that somebody else might think differently than you do. It makes it possible for you to reflect on your own experience and your own feelings. It makes it possible for you to take yourself as an object of study. Huh, why did I do that? Okay. The reflective attitude makes it possible for us to understand that there is more to a relationship than we might expect. If we're children, we take people pretty much at face value. As you start to enter adolescence, you get the intellectual skills to say, wait a minute, I wonder what she really meant by that. I wonder what she really thinks. I wonder if she's really telling me the truth. I wonder if he really thinks about me. There are all these wonders that you can have based on hypothetical possibilities. Remember those? Informal operational thinking. Being able to come up with hypotheses and think about the possibilities because you know that you're not expressing yourself honestly all the time. You're not telling everybody exactly how you feel or what you think. You're still trying to figure out what you think and what you feel, but you're aware of that as you develop toward adolescence. So you're becoming aware of the complexity of your thinking and your feeling and trying to figure out how to express yourself in a way that is valid. And in the process, you're learning that other people are doing the same thing. And you're really screwed up. And you really want somebody to understand you, but your parents can't, and your peers don't, and you often, as you move in, we often feel rather isolated by the distance between us and other people as we become cognitively able to understand the complexity of that. So adolescents have the potential to feel the need for an intimate relationship. Intimate in the psychological sense, not physical, the psychological sense of having somebody actually understand you and pay attention to you and care about you and think with you and reciprocally to share how they're feeling with you, to share their thoughts with you. And we typically don't feel intimate with somebody before we've experienced the lack of intimacy, which he describes as loneliness. He says, kids don't feel lonely until they have the need for intimacy. He says little kids are bored. They don't have anything to do. But they don't feel lonely because they don't feel the need for intimacy until you get up into middle grade school and moving on toward adolescence. And loneliness is the feeling that you have, even if you're in a group of people, even if you're at a crowded party at UVM, loneliness is the feeling that you have that here are all these people and not a single person here knows me. Not a single person here really cares to know me. And there isn't a single person here that I can really talk with about how I'm really feeling deep down inside. That's what loneliness is about. It's the absence of intimacy, and intimacy is about being able to share what's really going on inside between two people, which requires a lot of trust, requires a lot of practice, and for most of us involves a lot of failure at intimacy. Remember junior high school? Best friends, right? Best friends. Tell your secrets to your best friends, right? With the expectation that they will not share them with anybody else, and they will accept you as you are, and they will not gossip about you, and all of those things. Junior high school is about developing the skills of intimacy. And it is the important part for Sullivan of going into adolescence, of learning to talk about how you feel and what you think, learning to hear what somebody else is saying and thinking and feeling, being able to do that in a way that doesn't violate the other person's security. Aha! What's going on in adolescence is that you're trying to maintain a relationship that is secure and intimate. And when somebody violates the intimacy, they make you anxious. So if you think somebody is going to go talk about what you said in the wrong place to the wrong person and make fun of you, then the relationship is not secure, and you can't have an intimate relationship if you don't also have the security. Now hang on to that idea all the way through Thanksgiving, and we'll wrap that one up on Monday. Have a great holiday, and come back safe and healthy.